From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. As of yesterday, there have been 2,010 people diagnosed with COVID-19 in New Hampshire and 60 deaths, with about 12% of cases resulting in hospitalization. With COVID-19 contributing to so many deaths across the country, it is not surprising that many of us may be thinking more about getting our affairs in order. Has the coronavirus pandemic made you think more about end-of-life planning, like advance directives, a living will, or a power of attorney? Are you updating your estate plan or having conversations with your family about it? And what questions do you have about what you should do to prepare? Give us a call now. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send your questions by email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. With us on the program today is Donaldson Cavitch. He is attorney at the Estate Preservation and Planning Law Office located in Amherst. He's with us by Skype today. And Brian Kugel, coordinator of the Healthcare Decisions Coalition at the Foundation for Healthy Communities, where he oversees the Advanced Planning Initiative. Thanks to both of you for being here today. Really appreciate it.
Pleasure.
Good morning.
So obviously right now, people may be thinking more carefully about their end-of-life care, especially healthcare workers or people who may be at high risk. Have you seen this in your work, Donald? People being more concerned about this right now?
I've seen a little bit, and I'm hearing a fair bit from my colleagues in the Boston area in southern New Hampshire about getting more calls from healthcare workers specifically saying, hey, I'm an ER nurse. I need to go to the front lines, and I'm worried about doing my own end-of-life planning.
And how about you, Brian? Have you seen more interest in end-of-life planning since the COVID-19 pandemic?
We're hearing reports from people in healthcare settings that they are getting direct requests from patients or potential patients about advanced directives.
About patients as well. Okay.
Yes.
And has the COVID-19 pandemic made these conversations or your jobs in general more urgent, more complicated? How would you describe it, Brian?
Well, it's more complicated in that the in order to set up an advance directive, you need to have either a notary or a witness or two witnesses who are not part of the healthcare system to make the documents valid. And that's awkward right now. That's difficult given social isolation. Mm-hmm. And those are some of the kinds of questions that are coming our way.
An order issued by the governor, though, that would allow video and audio conferencing for witnesses for this kind of thing?
The governor's order, as I understand it, allows notaries to verify a signature while viewing that online, as opposed to needing to be in the presence of the signer. But I don't believe that it applies to witnesses who are not notaries.
What about you, Donald Sienkiewicz? Has the COVID-19 pandemic complicated the work you've been doing or changed it somehow?
So personally, it has not, and that's only because we've been doing Zoom meetings with clients for a couple of years. The only thing different is that about 6 weeks ago, we had our last face-to-face meeting. But I can tell you that for lawyers generally, it has complicated it in exactly the way that Brian just mentioned. We do have a remote notary order. That's Governor Sununu's Emergency Order 11 that he put in on March 23rd that allows notaries to witness and notarize documents. And basically every estate planning document you can do can be made valid by a notary. An alternate is two layperson witnesses. But the bigger problem is wills, which require two layperson witnesses to be valid. And there's a bit of a debate among us lawyers right now about whether we can do that online. Lots of my colleagues are doing this by having drive-by signings in their parking lots. And a lot of colleagues are reporting on our Bar Association listserv that they want to go do planning for someone who's in a nursing home, but of course they can't get into the nursing home or the hospital. So yeah, it's a tricky thing.
Sounds complicated, trying to get to close to people who might need the help. I wanted to talk about the two types of planning people might need to do right now. There's financial planning, which we'll talk about in depth, and healthcare planning, which we'll talk about in this first part of the program. But Donald, can you explain the difference between the two? I mean, why is each important? But they're important in different ways, as far as I understand.
Well, I guess they're important because we don't know what's going to happen to you, right? I mean, we'd all like to die peacefully in our sleep at home, surrounded by our loved ones, but that doesn't always happen. So the healthcare planning, it's really important that you have a healthcare power of attorney, or as we tend to call it in Massachusetts, a healthcare proxy, where you delegate while you're alive and in your right mind the authority to someone else to make healthcare decisions for you. There's also something called a living will, which is sort of a philosophical statement, which is in New Hampshire, it's part of a two-part document called an advance directive. So if you're quite confident you're going to die suddenly and peacefully in your sleep, you don't need one of these. But if there's any chance, then you really ought to do that healthcare planning. The financial planning, I suppose, you ought to have a will or a trust, or be really confident about what your beneficiary designations are on your life insurance policies and your retirement accounts and how your real estate is going to pass, just to make sure that your stuff and your money goes to who you want, when you want, in the manner you want. So that's how I divide those two conceptually.
And Brian, do you have anything to add to what Donald was saying?
No, it's a very good description.
With respect to power of attorney, you mentioned a lot there, Donald. I wanted to sort of break them down over the course of the hour today. So power of attorney, advance directive, these are the kind of things that you would need to have in place if you are still alive but incapacitated. You can't move your own money around, for example, or you can't make decisions about your health, what kind of medical treatment you would want, right? Is that where you would put this kind of information?
That's right. So that goes in the healthcare power of attorney. Well, so we call it the advance directive, which I think is a terrible and vague title. The advance directive in New Hampshire contains the power of attorney, where you say this is who gets to make decisions, including potentially pulling the plug on me if I can't make and communicate my own decisions. And it's also got this piece, the living will, which is sort of a one size fits all philosophical statement.
What do you mean by that philosophical statement in this
case? The living will, this sort of the statutory, the legislature has suggested a statutory living will form that basically is a right to die kind of statement. And you don't have to have one. I think they became popular when hospital administrators and nursing home administrators were tearing their hair out during the Terry Schiavo case, which was back in the 80s. And there's another famous case where someone was in a coma in a nursing home for a long time. And, some of the family members wanted to end their life and some other family members didn't want to end their life. And the living will is basically a statement, because what we value in America most of all is individual liberty and self-determination. This is what I would want at the end of my life. But it's heavily slanted towards let me die. If I'm in a coma or if my death is imminent, let me die. And that's not the most. So that's important if you don't have a healthcare power of attorney. If there's nobody that you've delegated the authority to, and there's no family member or close person to you who can tell the hospital this is what they would have wanted, then I guess it is important to have that living will. Otherwise, the really important thing is that you have a healthcare power of attorney, where if you're in a coma or if you've got advanced Alzheimer's or some kind of mental illness and you cannot make and communicate your own healthcare decision, this is the estate planning document that I think everybody ought to have, bar none, when they turn 18, is you ought to have the healthcare power of attorney.
I'll jump in and endorse that statement. I think that the living will was historically the first advance directive that was introduced in New Hampshire, later followed by the power of attorney for healthcare. And under this statute, the power of attorney for healthcare is a more powerful document. It presumes, it gives a human being the authority to figure out in real time what you would have wanted. And the law recognizes that as a stronger statement than the living will. But you're right. If there is no one to speak for you, it is a pretty limited, focused document that says, this is what I don't give consent to if I'm dying.
I see. So a power of attorney would give a person the ability to make decisions either based on the advance directive, the living will, or if there is not one of those in place, to make the judgment that they feel is in the best interest of that person who named them the power of attorney. Am I summarizing that kind of correctly?
Ideally, it is based on a conversation that you have with that agent, that power of attorney, that proxy. You are asking someone and assigning someone to act on your behalf and do what they understand you would have done if you were able to to be aware of what your circumstances were. And so when we teach people in the healthcare sector and in the related sectors to help people to put these things in place, we really focus on having that conversation, those conversations with the person you're going to ask to be your agent. It's a terrible, terrible thing to find out in a crisis that someone you love dearly has made you responsible for making a life or death decision, and you don't have a clue what they would have wanted to do. You will do it, and you will wonder for the rest of your life if you did what he or she would have wanted. So we do stress the documents are very important, but even more important is having that understanding so that people know how to stand up for you and be your agent and be your proxy.
We do not have a physician on the show today, but we wanted to include the perspective of a palliative care doctor who has been thinking about healthcare decisions in the time of COVID-19. And these are excerpts from an interview with Dr. Jessica Zitter, a critical and palliative care specialist who spoke on All Things Considered last week. And she spoke about the value of an advance directive.
Well, an advance directive really is such an important thing to have. It really helps to make sure that your preferences are honored at the end of life. And we're all sort of confronting that vision. We see it's up close and personal with the COVID-19 epidemic, pandemic. So, you know, COVID or not, there's a time when further intervention in the hospital just isn't going to help and actually can make things worse or increase suffering. So, you know, the default in our healthcare system is to just keep treating, keep adding on machines, connecting people to life support. And often, you know, this happens until someone dies. And then there's just a rising number of deaths in facilities where patients are just living on machinery. And it's really not what people say they would want in their lives. So that's why planning in advance and creating an advance directive and thinking about these things is such a critically important process. And again, I want to say one more thing, which is that the advance directive is not just a static form. It's a process of thinking about your values and thinking about how that will translate into what you want at the end of life and communicating that very important information to your loved ones who will be the ones who would have to speak for you if you can't speak for yourself.
That's Dr. Jessica Zitter, critical and palliative care specialist, speaking on All Things Considered about the value of an advance directive. We want to take some of your calls and emails. Give us a call if you have questions or comments about end-of-life planning, whether it be medical or financial. 1-800-892-6477 or email exchange at nhpr.org. We got this note from Nan, who wrote in to say, "Thank you so much for discussing end-of-life planning. Please remind folks that a durable power of attorney for healthcare is not in effect until a physician or nurse practitioner has assessed the person, deemed them incapacitated, and written an order activating the durable power of attorney for healthcare." Nan continues, "I cannot tell you how many times people have waved papers in my face stating, usually with great intensity, I am the power of attorney, and expecting access to protected health information and other activities that an activated durable power of attorney for healthcare would have access to, such as signing care plans. I find myself doing a great deal of community education regarding incapacity possibly being transient and the ability of the durable power of attorney for healthcare to be repeatedly activated and rescinded as opposed to incompetence that is adjudicated with the more enduring guardianship." Thanks very much for your comments, Nan. I wanted to get insights from Donald Sienkiewicz and Brian Kugel about this. We'll start with you, Donald. What do you make of Nan's comments?
Yeah, Nan's absolutely right. I would say the legal profession and the medical profession speak two different languages, and they always don't always translate. So on the legal side, again, in America, what we're really mostly concerned about is individual liberty and self-determination. And so things like HIPAA, the Healthcare Information Privacy Act, I'm not going to get the acronym exactly right, is very concerned. I think the medical profession has taken this to heart with protecting people's information and their liberty. And so this is often sort of alien and surprising to loved ones, family members, even spouses who walk in and say, "I've got the power of attorney." These healthcare powers of attorney are typically written to be what we lawyers call springing. That is, they're not self-executing. They're not like a little paper magic wand. It does require a doctor, and our statutory form says two physicians or a physician and an advanced registered nurse practitioner, I think that's a nurse with a master's degree, have to have determined that you are, well, so I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself, and that's sort of an end-of-life decision. But definitely there has to be a determination by a healthcare professional that you can't make and communicate your own decisions. Financial powers of attorney would tend to do a little bit differently. Those in my practice I often do to be immediately effective. You got to be a little bit careful because it's a bit like a blank check. But that's true. There needs to be a handoff from the legal side to the medical side. And another really interesting element of this is what Brian works on with these provider order or medical order for life-sustaining treatment, these actual DNR orders or, I suppose, resuscitate orders.
Mm-hmm. Brian, did you want to weigh in?
Again, it was a good comment. It's very important. Some people are frightened to say, well, I'm not ready for that. I don't need that yet. I'm fine. I have all my marbles. I understand what's going on. The fact is, if you complete an advance directive, it does not go into effect until the day comes when your care team understands that you don't get it. You don't understand what's going on. In the healthcare setting, we don't want to impose anything on somebody without their endorsement, without their consent. And if doctors, nurse practitioners are feeling that the patient doesn't fully get it, they're looking to go to somebody who does get it, who can make a decision on behalf of the patient. That does not go into effect until that day comes. And as the person who called or the person who sent the note indicated, that sometimes comes in and comes out. COVID is a good example. It's a terrible occasion, but it's a good example because if there are people who go into a ventilator and they're put in a medical coma so that they can tolerate the ventilator, during that period of time, they're not aware of anything. So the medical team needs somebody to speak on behalf of that patient. And if the treatment is successful and the vent is removed and the patient comes back to awareness, there's no longer a need for that power of attorney to be active. So it's, I think, important to realize that if you fill something out, it doesn't mean that somebody else is entitled to make your decisions for you today. Only come the day that you really need that.
Okay. Once you are recovered, if you recover, that would be no longer in effect until such time as a similar condition arises and a medical professional says, okay, this needs to go into effect again. Let's talk to Karen in Plainfield. Karen, thank you very much for calling. What's your comment?
Oh, thank you for talking with me. I wanted to suggest something that people can do that isn't quite as legal and quite as medical, and it really just has to do with searching through your house or your computer or your notebooks for all your passwords, all your bank accounts, all your doctor's names and numbers.
Mm-hmm. What are the book recommendations? Did you have book recommendations, Karen?
Yes, I had a book recommendation. It's put out by a non-profit insurance company called Thrivent, and the two books are Step by Step and Mourning with Hope. So the one obviously is after somebody has died. And Step by Step helps prepare you for all these legal and medical paperwork. And you can collect all the information that will help your lawyers.
Well, Karen, thank you very much. Really appreciate the call. So a couple of book recommendations there for getting one's affairs in order. We got this note from Susan in Exeter who responded to our coronavirus survey at nhpr.org. She said, I startled my daughter with an email that talked about my possible death and some things that I might have forgotten to tell her. I do better writing since I have thought it out. I have all the usual things with my daughter and a lawyer, but now if you're currently worried about dying, tell your kids what you have been thinking about and tell one person where all the paperwork is in your house or apartment. Get it all together in a pile and put it in one place and tell your child designee where it is. And be sure they know the name, address, and phone number of your lawyer. It gave me a sense of relief to do that. Brian Kugel, can I ask you about one thing in Susan's note to say? She said tell one person. Is that a good idea, just to tell one person, or should more than one person be aware of this?
I would hope that you'd tell more than one person. Going back to the advance directive by way of illustration, there's room there to name more than one person as your agent, with the presumption that the advance directive lasts forever until you change it or discontinue it. And people change over time. So if I have three children and I name the one of them to be the primary agent, that person may move away, may become ill, may pass away. And without my having to do anything different, I have named a second person who would be responsible. I think the advice is very practical to give more than one person an idea of where to look to find the things that are important.
A different question for you, Donald Sienkiewicz. With respect to the advance directive, is that where you would put things like organ donation desires or preferences?
Yep, sure is. And our statutory form that I think most of us lawyers use has basically three choices. You know, I want to authorize my agent to donate any needed organs and or tissues. The other choice is no, I don't, or C, gosh, I need to think about this. I don't want to make any decisions right now. And then, of course, you can be more specific than that. You can say, I don't know, kidneys, but not lungs.
Yeah.
I haven't had anybody do that yet.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So for putting together a power of attorney or advance directive, is an attorney necessary? People may be concerned about, oh, geez, I don't know if I have the money to see an attorney to put this together. Is there a way to do this with online resources?
Sure. You can download the statutory form power of attorney for healthcare and living will right from the internet. I don't recommend it, and not just because this is how I make my living. I think these forms are really confusing. The statutory forms are created by legislative committees, you know, the whole sausage-making process. And they're full of double negatives and all sorts of very confusing stuff. That whole objection to treatment in the case of incapacity is really tricky. And the thing about somebody like me or any number of our qualified colleagues, lots of good estate planning lawyers in the state of New Hampshire, we do this every day. We go through these choices. We explain them. So it's worth spending a few $100 to make sure that you understand the choices. But no, there's no legal requirement that you hire a lawyer. Absolutely not.
Mm-hmm. Brian, do you know of a specific online resource that you would direct
people to? Yes, our organization provides that online at our website at New Hampshire Foundation for Healthy Communities, and it is free. We also publish the form in a guidebook, and it's slightly paraphrased to weigh a little more toward the English language than the statute itself is, but it's true to the statute. But I think you're right, particularly with regard to estate matters. I would not advise avoiding a lawyer when it comes to setting up those other contingencies for trusts and things like that. For advanced directives for healthcare, we do have people in the healthcare setting that are trained to have those discussions with people to illustrate where they might be used and how they play out in the healthcare setting, and people often need to know that.
Listeners, we're talking today about end-of-life planning. Coming up after a break, we'll talk about some of the things you should think about when getting your financial house in order. Some of the things we've just been mentioning, wills, trusts, maybe even we'll talk about transfer on death designations. We'll talk about probate court. We'll talk about all of these things. If you have a specific question or a story about end-of-life care that you'd like to share, call us now. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email exchange at nhpr.org. This is The Exchange. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and today we're talking about end-of-life planning. The coronavirus pandemic has brought our mortality into focus, so we're speaking with some knowledgeable people today about best practices when it comes to getting your affairs in order. What questions do you have about end-of-life planning? How did you have these conversations with your loved ones? We'll spend some time in this part of the program talking about financial planning. With me today are Donald Sienkiewicz, attorney at the Estate Preservation and Planning Law Office located in Amherst. He's with us by Skype. And Brian Kugel, coordinator for the Healthcare Decisions Coalition at the Foundation for Healthy Communities, where he oversees the Advanced Planning Initiative. Donald, when it comes to finances, what's the most basic thing a person can do to ensure that when they die, the financial process goes smoothly?
Go see a lawyer who specializes in this. It's very confusing. I get really common questions when people come in. They say, I think I need to do a will. And, you know, half an hour into the consultation process, it becomes very clear they don't realize that, for example, the will does not trump their beneficiary designations on their life insurance. They're not even thinking about their employer-sponsored group term life insurance. It doesn't trump the beneficiary designations on their retirement accounts unless those fail because the beneficiary is also dead. This stuff is really complicated. I did commercial real estate for 7 or 8 years before I got into trusts and estates. I got into trusts and estates accidentally because I lost my job in the last Great Recession. And I realized, even as a lawyer, I didn't understand this stuff. And it took me a long time to feel competent. Mm-hmm. So, another plug for lawyers. That's what I'm going to give you.
Okay. So see a lawyer because it can get pretty complicated. Same question to you, Brian. What would be the most basic thing you would advise?
Well, I would have the same advice. You should see a lawyer to get your financial affairs in order. Estate law is complicated. We are asked, since we provide advanced directive forms and then guidance to people in the healthcare center, do you have a form for to name a power of attorney for my estate? And we say no. That's very complicated stuff.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about the will question, because my understanding of wills is that, yes, even though it doesn't change the designation of your life insurance beneficiary, for example, it would speed things up in probate court for whatever assets do have to go through probate court, because a will, generally speaking, will designate a personal representative for the estate or an executor for the estate who is essentially make all the decisions for the estate and be financially responsible for settling debts and whatnot. Is that a good thing to have in place, if nothing else in a will, just a designation of an executor of the estate, Donald?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you do a will with a lawyer or with an online service, it's going to make you designate an executor, someone who executes or carries out your instructions. It's going to nominate them. Only the probate court can actually invest them with authority. So a will is a ticket to a probate court experience. Will it speed it up, having a will? Maybe, maybe not. If you, in all 50 states, we've got these rules for someone dies intestate, that is without a will and testament. So there's sort of these King Solomon split the baby kind of rules, like did the guy die with a spouse? Did the guy die with kids? And they sort of have these arbitrary fractions. You really don't want the state to determine who gets what under the intestacy statute. So a will says basically, here's who carries out or executes my instructions, and here's who gets what. And if you've got minor kids or disabled kids, that's also the place where traditionally we nominate a guardian for them. But it's really important to recognize that almost every different kind of asset has a different rule for how it transfers. There's been a sea change probably in the last generation about financial assets being able to be transferred on death, registered transferred on death to somebody else. That avoids the probate process.
That can be for bank accounts and online brokerage accounts, things like that. You can go to the bank and just say, hey, I want this account when I die to go to X person.
Right. So you could have $10 million in a Schwab or Fidelity account. And if it's transfer on death to, you know, your kid, that's all they're going to have to do is positively identify themselves by sending in a death certificate to Schwab or Fidelity or Vanguard or whoever, and they're going to get the money. No lawyer is going to pay any attention. So that's fine, and that may be absolutely appropriate. But the problem is, the big takeaway I'd like people to take away from the show is that you want to work with someone who understands the whole process and how each one of your assets is going to transfer, because it's way more complex than just, I'm going to do a will.
Brian, agree? It's way more complex than just writing a will?
As a consumer, I'd say yes.
As a consumer, rather than as someone who works professionally in this.
Well, as a person who works professionally, we do see that it's complex, and people do need guidance and advice from people who know the laws.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and we spent the first part of the program talking a little bit about healthcare planning and financial planning. To what extent do these overlap, Brian?
Well, a good portion of people who have advanced directives for healthcare have them because they were raised in the course of estate planning. So many of those are generated in lawyers' offices, and that's very good. We have an interest in seeing that you or anybody has what you want and has your consent or has your guidance expressed either through a document or through some other human being you've assigned. All we want to do is to know what you want and to make sure that the healthcare system is set up to follow it. So we do have people, though, that wills change. Not wills, but advanced directives change. People's circumstances change. Their views change. And so a lot of them are done outside of attorney's offices. However, the financial things really should be done in with the help of an attorney.
Listeners, if you've got questions about financial planning for end-of-life care or anything like that, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477 or email exchange at nhpr.org. We'd love to get your question answered. If you also have a story that you think other listeners may benefit from hearing from, so give us a call to tell us that story, 1-800-892-6477. We heard from Walter in Portsmouth, who says, my father created a will, trust, advanced directive, and medical power of attorney. Then he got dementia. He did not have anyone with a financial power of attorney, which caused big problems for dealing with income outside of the trust. So a financial power of attorney, in Walter's case, that would be like the medical power of attorney, where it is in effect so long as the person it is for is alive but incapacitated in some way. Am I describing that correctly, Donald?
That's correct. I sort of think of three possible states, right? Alive and in your right mind, alive and not in your right mind, and dead. A will only works the minute you die. Powers of attorney, both healthcare and financial, work while you're alive but mentally incapacitated. And a trust works both when you're alive and healthy, when you're alive and incapacitated, and also after you die. That's one reason lawyers love trusts. They're very flexible. And I would suspect that one of the problems with Walter's father was that the trust was not fully funded. Not everything was in the trust. And had been in the trust, if all the assets had been in the trust, the successor trustee, whoever was named after Walter's father, would have had pretty instant access and control to those assets.
I see. We've got this question from Liz in Pelham, who writes, my husband and I live in New Hampshire. He works in New Hampshire. I work in Massachusetts, but we seek all of our health care in Massachusetts. What documents translate across state lines if we had to seek health care in New Hampshire? Do we need separate health care proxy forms specific to New Hampshire?
I'll have a go at this one.
Sure.
The law in New Hampshire says that we will recognize healthcare proxies, powers of attorney executed in another state, provided they meet our requirements. And there's a devil in that detail, because some of the particulars in the New Hampshire statute are different from any other state. And that's true of every state. Every state writes their own statute. And what I have an interest, and I think everybody has an interest in seeing happen, is that whatever you do, it's understood, it works. The people that it instructs know what to do with it and how to be instructed. So even though technically a Massachusetts statute, or a Massachusetts document would be recognized in New Hampshire, and practically people here would try to honor it, they would try to figure it out. But I want to make sure that you put the tennis ball right on the other guy's racket when it crosses the net. And so that there is less confusion. The worst thing that can happen is people say, I'm not sure what to do. Let's do what we normally do and figure it out later. And what we normally do in the healthcare setting may or may not be what you want. So it's in your interest if you, and many people do this. Many people get some care in New Hampshire. They get specialty care in Massachusetts. There are people in every state who live in borders. The Connecticut River and in Vermont is an example here. It's worth your while to do a form in New Hampshire. Again, you may have done part of estate planning in one state, but it's inexpensive. It's free to do the healthcare proxy, a duplicate of that. It's important to make sure they say the same things.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk to Robin in North Conway. Robin, thank you very much for calling. What's your question or comment?
Thank you for taking my call. Great subject. I had a question on, we did all our healthcare proxy, durable power of attorney for healthcare, the dementia paperwork. And what if a partner is starting to show signs of possible dementia? You know, people are talking to me about revocable and irrevocable trust. I was wondering, you know, what your thoughts are on that.
So a question about dementia as it relates to revocable and irrevocable trusts. Robin, thank you very much for the call. Maybe before we get into the details of how dementia might affect that, Donald, can you explain what revocable and irrevocable trusts are?
So this is a simplistic way of dividing the world of trusts into two. Revocable trusts, when you create them, you can change them. You can revoke them. You can tear them up entirely. I think of a trust as a bucket with rules carved on the side, so you can also just change the rules slightly. You know, this kid didn't send me a Christmas card, so they only get 40% instead of 50%. You can put stuff into the bucket. You can take stuff out of the bucket. Very flexible. They're great tools for just making things easy for your loved ones and cheap for your loved ones when you pass away or lose mental capacity. They don't protect you against people you owe money to. And the person or institution that most of us people who aren't in high-risk professions are likely to owe money to is a nursing home at the end of life. And so these irrevocable trusts are trusts where you build the bucket by signing a document, you carve the rules on the side, and then you say, as soon as I sign this, I hereby give up the right to change the rules. And whatever you put in that bucket, if it passes this five-year look back for Medicaid, then it is safe from being used to pay for your nursing homes. And that's a very specialized, a powerful tool in the hands of people who understand how to use them. And so those kind of irrevocable trusts that you can't change the rules, those will protect the assets inside for your kids or whoever, your loved ones, against people potentially that you owe money to.
And so Robin's question had to do in part on someone showing signs of dementia. So if they don't have dementia yet, but it might be coming. And so to protect assets, to what extent would a trust be a tool in that case?
Well, I hope this is responsive. The earlier someone does planning, the better the chance that assets will be protected. That is, if you've already got dementia, it may be too late for you to do any planning. Probably, you know, if you've got a spouse, they may be able to do some emergency planning. But this kind of planning, everything we're talking about on the show is far better done the earlier the better. Mm-hmm. It's possible to do some irrevocable trust and other Medicaid planning when someone has gotten a diagnosis of dementia. And it's pretty interesting. Legally, you can make or change an estate plan even if you have been diagnosed with dementia. But you have to know what you're doing at the time that you go see the lawyer or make the estate plan. And that can get tricky, especially if after you die, people aren't happy with the estate plan and they challenge it.
Is that something you've seen, Brian, challenges to estate plans after they've been drawn up by people who aren't happy with what's in there?
It's rare. I don't see so much the estate plan as the authority that's in the power of attorney for healthcare. It's rare that it's contested, but we do train people and warn people to be extremely careful to make sure that when someone is executing an advanced care plan and an advanced directive, that they are capable of doing that they do have capacity. The question about dementia is very, very challenging, because dementia is a very gradual, insidious illness. And I'm going back to what Donald said very much earlier in the program. Our culture, our society is based on, and our law is based on the premise that people have individual freedom and abilities to choose things. And our laws and our culture are very reluctant to remove that from people. So with a dementia, which progresses from very, very subtle to very profound, at what point is it fair to say that the individual should no longer be making this or that decision? And that is very tricky ground. I can, if I am in the early stages of dementia, I can make errors in judgment. I can spend money on things I didn't used to spend money on. Does that give the rest of society the prerogative to take my choosing ability away from me? It's a question of when.
Certainly sounds.
Doctors are very reluctant to remove somebody's capacity, declare somebody incapable of making medical decisions. And even when they do, doctors, nurse practitioners, healthcare providers do include that patient in the discussion, even knowing that they don't fully understand it. So it's a gradual thing, and there is room for error. There is room for worry.
Well, seems like it might be worth contacting an attorney for any specific case. Robin, thank you very much for the call. Really appreciate that. We've got a quick question from a caller who couldn't stay on the line but wanted to know if the power of attorney needs to be one person or could it be a majority. The person who called had three children and wonders if all three could vote on decisions and spell out the majority, two out of three, in favor of a decision, that decision would go forward. Would that work, Brian?
The law is weighted toward clarifying one individual. You can specify, I want all three. We advise against it simply because in real time, you may not be able to find all three and the decision may not wait. But what we often guide people to do and encourage people to do is name all three as a primary and then alternate agents and include in the form, which there is space for this, to encourage those three to consult with one another about any important decision.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll continue our discussion on some of these financial issues. We'll talk also a little bit about what it's like to start this conversation. It can be an emotional, kind of sad moment to have this conversation, but as we've been hearing on the program, it seems wise to plan as many of these details in advance as possible. Put the ball right on the person's racket, so to speak. So let's call, let's talk now if you have questions. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and as of this morning, nearly 60,000 people have died nationwide from COVID-19. With that number growing daily, it's hard not to think about how vulnerable the human body is, and consequently, what to do to prepare for a scenario when you or a family member becomes critically ill. We're talking with our guests today about end-of-life planning, medical, financial, and in this part of the program, we're going to talk about having the conversation with loved ones about end-of-life planning, your own or theirs. With me on the program today, Donald Sinkovich. He is attorney at the Estate Preservation and Planning Law Office located in Amherst. He's on Skype. And Brian Kugel, coordinator for the Healthcare Decisions Coalition at the Foundation for Healthy Communities. We're still getting questions about finances. It's a tricky part of the end-of-life decision-making process. So Dennis from Stewartstown, he wanted to know about gifting before death instead of putting it all in a will. Donald, what do you make of that, giving your assets away to loved ones, family members before death to avoid any kind of after-death transfer problems?
Sure. It's great to be generous. You should see a lawyer and talk about your specific circumstances. You know, people get confused about this too. So you can give $15,000 a year to anybody, any individual on the planet without telling the IRS about it. You can probably give a lot more than that without paying any tax on it, given the gift and estate tax thresholds, like $11.4 million a person. That's very different from the Medicaid rules and the five-year look back, and you need to be really careful. Medicaid and long-term care planning is the 800-pound gorilla in everybody's estate plan. But sure, generically, it's you can give stuff away. You don't have to wait until you die. But you should really talk to a lawyer who specializes in this kind of practice. A great resource, by the way, is NALA, the National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys. I would not advise going to the local lawyer who does a little divorce, a little real estate. I discovered when I got into this area 10 years ago that you can get over your head in the deep end of the pool very quickly. So NALA is a great resource for finding lawyers who've made a commitment to this area of practice.
We'll make sure we can put links up to the resources you mentioned at our website, nhpr.org, so listeners can check that out at the end of the program. John in Goffstown wrote in to say, my father did not plan well, and it was a nightmare at the end of his life, since drawing up all these legal papers last minute was almost questionable. The medical and financial powers of attorney took some time to execute and caused many problems. The probate process was long and complicated. On the other hand, my mother had planned well, and the whole process from financial and medical POAs, will, and probate went smoothly. My wife and I had our legal documents drawn up immediately following the debacle of my father's passing. That's the comment from him. And we also have Jody in Merrimack who wrote in and said, after a couple of unexpected deaths in our extended family, we held a morbid dinner party. The purpose was to get our three generations together and go through the advance directive paperwork and fill it out together. So that was one way of starting the conversation. Thank you very much for that comment, Jody. Really appreciate it. Let's talk now with Meredith in Concord. Meredith, thank you very much for calling. What's your question or comment?
Thank you so much. This is such an important conversation. And I love the dinner party suggestion. I have a lawyer friend who once said to me, if you don't make a plan, someone else is going to have to do it for you. And unfortunately, that's not compelling for some people to make a plan. And I just wonder if the experts have any advice. You know, how do you get someone to be comfortable talking about this and to really realize the position that they put, you know, probably their children in if they just completely refuse to engage in this topic? Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call, Meredith. What do you think? Maybe we'll start with you, Donald.
It's tough. I would say, look, Mom, Dad, I love you. I care about you. I want to have this conversation. Are you willing to have this conversation? I think actually there's some links on the show website. Back in 2013 or 2014, somebody started calling it The Conversation, capital T, capital C. This conversation about end of life, which, of course, in America, where we sort of idolize youth and vitality, and we're absolutely phobic about aging, disease, and death, it's often a tricky conversation. But I would just say, look, I love you. Can we have this conversation?
Mm-hmm. Same with you, Brian. Have you seen stories of this in your line of work, people trying to convince family members?
I'll add that the Conversation Project, that is a very useful toolkit and resource. It's a discussion people don't want to have. We do want to assume we'll always live. It can ruin a Thanksgiving dinner to bring it up, you know. On the other hand, I've spent a lot of time wishing that there was an easy way to get people to engage in this discussion. And they say be careful what you wish for, because we do have a worldwide crisis now, okay. And all of a sudden, the possibilities, the illustration becomes easy to imagine, okay. And so this may be an opportunity. We spend a lot of time on the phone because we're in the house a lot with people we love, checking in. And it may be more possible in this dark time to engage in this kind of sad discussion, this kind of important but serious and solemn discussion, to say, I love you, Mom. I love you, Dad. Or to your kids, look, if anything happens, you've said you'd be willing to speak for me. These are the things that I would say. These are the ways I feel about it right now. And those are really, really important discussions to have.
Let's talk to Jeff in Concord. Jeff, thank you very much for calling. What's on your mind?
Yes, I'd like to know. I'm trying to get my will done now, but I'm afraid to go and meet with a lawyer in person. And I am concerned about using the online will services. Is there a way for a lawyer to help me do my will safely, you know, remotely?
Donald, Brian, who wants this question?
I'll take it. So sure, yeah. I should know that Jeff and I are friends.
Okay.
Jeff, you got to call me and pay me to do your will. I mean, that's the answer. So they're all lawyers all over the country are being very creative. They're having drive-through signings where paralegals, witnesses are standing in parking lots. We do it all video. As long as you've got a smartphone and a laptop or something with a camera, a smartphone and a decent internet connection, we can do estate planning for anybody in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts or New Hampshire, or the states that I'm licensed in. And I meet with clients when we're not in COVID-19 in Peterborough at Phil Runyon's law office, where I'm a partner, and recently at Paul Pike's office up in Wolfboro. There are lots of great lawyers. I think the big issue is people are scared of lawyers. They think lawyers are expensive and they're going to bite. Really, most of us are pretty nice people. We were people before we went to law school. When we retire, we'll be people again. I got a bunch of videos on my website. You can show Mom some of the videos and say, look, this guy seems like a down-to-earth person. He won't bite. But the first thing to do is just pick up the phone and make an appointment with a lawyer. And most lawyers will have video appointments, phone appointments now.
But asking people to sort of, hey, overcome your fear, get over it. I mean, that's tough, right? I mean, some people just really don't want to interact with people right now either. And some people may be, as you mentioned, just wary of lawyers in general. So what about for people who can't do what you recommend or really just don't want to and aren't going to muster the strength to do it your way? Is there a different way to do it, Donald?
There are any number of online will services. They use artificial intelligence to say, hey, what's your name? Who are you married to? Who do you want to get your stuff? Who do you want to be your executor? The first problem is if that spits out a will for you, you can print it out. You still have to find two witnesses to sign that will for it to be legally enforceable. Otherwise, the court's not going to honor that. The other thing, I'll just repeat what I've said two or three times before, is this stuff is more complicated than getting a document online or even going through one of these artificial intelligence services. You can do it without talking to a lawyer if you're too afraid of talking to a professional or you think, I really don't have the money. I think I'd rather talk to a lawyer and then find out how much it's going to cost and then decide whether to use a lawyer or not.
With respect to starting the conversation with family members about end-of-life decisions, we got this note from Shirley in Nashua. She writes, my mother started the conversation about end-of-life by sending me a card with a photo of her new tombstone. The card said, so you don't worry about this. She gave me no warning. So that's the approach from Shirley's mom, Shirley in Nashua. That's a creative way to tell people, hey, I'm taking care of stuff. Brian, is that something you've heard of before? People sort of, seems like there might be a sense of humor to it.
Attention, and I think that's probably important, but there may be gentler ways to do it. it is always a challenge when you try to figure out how do I get somebody else to do something I want them to do. This is certainly worth pursuing. It's certainly worth engaging, but there are a million different answers, not all of which are successful. It depends on the people.
It depends on the people, certainly. We got this note from Bill in Concord. He said, I ran into this when my little brother died unexpectedly a few years ago. He had no will. He had been estranged from my father for many years as dad considered his lifestyle a choice and a sin. Because I was the relative living closest to my brother, I became the executor of his estate. I had to wade through his assets and debts with the help of a lawyer I had to find on short notice. Because he had no will, after all the probate cleared, I had to hand over all the assets to my father, who promptly donated the money to organizations that advocated for causes that my brother would never have supported. My wife and I learned from this lesson and spent the time and money to make sure we had a will and health care directives in place. We look it over every few years to make sure it's all up to date. I now know for sure that our estate will be handled the way we want. So it seems like a cautionary tale from Bill, Brian, about, hey, if you don't spell things out the way you want to, all your material possessions may go towards something that you really don't want them to go toward.
Again, speaking from the healthcare side, the thing we would like most is for every adult to have at least considered whether they want to have an advanced medical directive. Yes, 20-year-olds don't pass away as frequently as 70-year-olds, but they do pass away. They do end up in comas. They do end up in unforeseen crises. And it for everyone who loves them, we would want to see that they have considered and instructed us how to handle that. And so it is a challenge because young people live forever, at least they think they do. And so we do want to see people consider this.
Let's talk to Michelle in Plymouth. Michelle, thank you very much for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I guess I'm just kind of curious what your advice is for like the non-traditional households. We've talked a little bit about traditional households of mom and dad and having kids and, you know, the advice to give to kids. What about families who don't have kids and or like just the non-traditional families? Instead of having a conversation with mom and dad, what about a conversation with mom and mom or dad and dad or families who chose or can't have kids? What's your advice for who they should be talking to instead of just traditional families?
Thanks, Michelle. Appreciate the call. What do you think, Brian?
Family is who you define your family to be, okay? They can be traditional relationships, they can be non-traditional relationships, they can be unofficial relationships. They can who I would choose to be my healthcare agent might be a family member, it might be a friend, it might be somebody in my church. It depends on my life circumstances. The law allows, and the healthcare system seeks the person or persons that you have in mind to speak on your behalf.
Donald, anything to add to that?
I agree. You know, a few years back when we said non-traditional families, what people were really talking about was same-sex couples. And after a couple of Supreme Court decisions, that's not really much of a thing anymore. Legally, there's almost no difference in planning for same-sex couples anymore as there was for traditional opposite-sex couples. But as Brian says, it's America. You can choose anybody you want to make decisions for you if you can't, and you can choose anybody you want to get your stuff. So again, sorry to beat the same drum. Go see a lawyer. That's the way to start.
That's Donald Sinkovich. He is attorney at the Estate Preservation and Planning Law Office located in Amherst, joining us by Skype. Also with us today, Brian Kugel, coordinator of the Healthcare Decisions Coalition at the Foundation for Healthy Communities. Thank you very much, both of you, for being on the program today.
Thanks, Peter.
So much to talk about in this hour. We're sorry we didn't get to everybody's questions or comments, but the conversation continues at our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, and at NHPR.org, where we've posted resources discussed on the show today. The show's producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Michael Brindley is our program manager. Jane Vaughn is production fellow for The Exchange, and our regular theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.